Competition. It's nice to be back in Austin. I want to talk about some joint work with Jess Banks, Chris Moore, and Praneeth Netrapelli, who was a PhD student here, which is about stochastic block models. Okay, and a stochastic block model is a random graph that's generated in the following way. So I call it GNKAB. N is always the number of nodes, okay, which eventually I will send to infinity. K is the number of colors that I have available. Okay, and so what I do is I have my n nodes and I divide them up by color with about the same number of nodes per color, so n over k nodes approximately. All right, and then once I have chosen the colors, I get a random graph in the following way. I take two nodes and I connect them with probability a over n if they have the same color and b over n if they have different colors. All right, and so here is a picture of a graph drawn from this model. K equals 2, so I have two colors. I think A was about 10, and B was about a half. So what you have is sort of two very large, sort of highly connected halves of the graph, and relatively few edges that connect the two halves. Okay, the colors are not meant to have any sort of particular political significance. All right. So there are two problems that I want to consider for graphs of this type. The first one is called the detection problem. The detection problem is you get to see the graph with no colors, okay, and the goal is to figure out what the colors were. Right? You want to more or less figure out the split into two colors. Okay, it's pretty easy to see, so I'll just remind you that my so n is going to go to infinity, and my connection probability is order 1 over n, so the graph has a constant average degree. Every node, you get basically a constant amount of information about it, so there's no way that you're going to get all of the colors right. All right. So when I say recover the colors, I only mean recover them to a sort of non-trivial extent. Right? You can always get some of them right just by guessing at random, and I want you to do a little bit better than that. All right? That's what I call detection. All right. So let me define it properly here. So I denote the color, so my colors are 1 up to k. I denote the color of the vertex v by sigma sub v. Okay, and now if I have two colorings, sigma and tau, then, okay, the overlap between sigma and tau is the fraction of vertices on which they agree, okay, minus 1 over k, because 1 over k is the fraction of vertices that they would agree on if I generated them at random. Okay, so an overlap of 0 is not very good. You can get an overlap of 0 just by guessing, and I want you to do more than that. Okay, I have to correct this a little bit because my graph, the way I generated the graph, it was sort of symmetric to what the identities of the colors were. Okay, so I take all possible relabelings of the colors and I take the maximum over those. Okay, when I do it like this, okay, the overlap is going to be something that's non-negative. Okay, right, and an overlap that's very close to zero is not very interesting. Okay, and the terminology that I will use. So I fix k, a and b, and I look at this model with n nodes. G is my graph, sigma is my labeling from this model. I'm going to take n to go to infinity, and I say that this sequence of random graphs is detectable if there was some epsilon, okay, and there was some algorithm which takes a graph and produces a labeling. All right, and I would like to have the following property. With probability bounded away from zero, the overlap between the true colors and the colors produced by the algorithm is bounded away from zero. Right? This is not asking very much. Right? It's only asking that I can do just a tiny little bit better with a tiny probability than a completely random guess. Okay. And if the sequence of graphs is not detectable, then I say it's undetectable. All right. So that's problem one, is to detect the communities given the uncolored graph. Problem two is sort of a bit simpler. I don't want you to detect the communities necessarily. I just want you to tell me if there are any. Okay, so I consider two random graph models. So this is my stochastic block model. Okay, and then I also consider the Oder-Sereny random graph with average degree d. Okay, where d is chosen to be the same as the average degree as it would be in the stochastic block model. Right, so if I'm in the stochastic block model, then I have on average a over k neighbors of my own color, and b over k neighbors for every color, for each of the k minus one other colors, right? So this is the average degree under that model, okay? So I'm comparing, just to say it again, a random graph model that has an underlying structure which is hidden, and a random graph model which has the same average degree but no underlying structure, and I'm asking you to tell me, given a graph, which one it came from. All right. So to make this question precise, I introduce these two notions, okay, which are sort of old notions about sequences of probability measures. I have two sequences of probability measures, P and Q, which are probability measures. So for every n, Pn and Qn is a probability measure, or probability measures on the same space. Okay, I say that these two sequences are contiguous if whenever I have a sequence of events has probability converging to zero under Pn, if and only if it is probability converging to zero under Qn. All right, that's contiguous. Orthogonal, the sequence is orthogonal if there is some sequence of events with probability going to zero under P and to one under Q. Okay. Now, obviously, these two notions are not exhaustive. You can come up with sequences which are sort of in between contiguous and orthogonal. Okay, but these are the ones that are going to be useful to me. So, so again, I'm looking at the asymptotics as n goes to infinity. So I take this stochastic block model with these parameters. Okay, and then as n goes to infinity, I compare it to the Erdős-Reni model. Okay, and I say that these two things are distinguishable if the two models are orthogonal to each other, and indistinguishable if the two models are contiguous with one another. Okay, so just to tie that into this question at the beginning, so this question at the beginning was sort of a statistical question, like a hypothesis testing question. You see your graph, and you're asked to decide which model it came from. Okay, so with that interpretation, distinguishable basically means that you can always tell. So you get your graph from one of these two models, with probability going to one, you're going to be extremely confident about which one it came from. Okay, indistinguishable basically means you can never tell for sure. Okay, it means you get your graph from one of these two models, and maybe you have some bias towards saying that it came from this one or that one, but with probability going to one over the graph that you saw, you are never going to really know which one it came from. Okay. All right, so I should have said maybe at the beginning that if there are any questions, please feel free to interrupt. So let me show you... So before I do that... all right, so I had these parameters A and B, where A over N was the edge probability of nodes that have the same color, and B over N was the edge probability for nodes that had different colors. Okay, I just want to reparameterize that because it's easier to state the results in terms of different parameters. So my parameter D here has already appeared. It's the average degree, okay, which is in terms of A and B and K, like this. And lambda, okay, is given by this formula, A minus B over A plus K minus 1 times B. Okay, it may not be entirely clear at this point why I should parameterize them in these terms, but it's pretty easy to see that if I give you K, D, and lambda, then it determines A and B. Okay, so this is just a reparameterization of my model. The reason lambda is called lambda is because it's actually an eigenvalue of something. Okay, so if I look at the graph locally, right, let's say I am a particular node in the graph, and I pick a neighbor, okay, and I don't yet see its color, then I can always ask, okay, given that my color is I, what's the conditional probability that its color is J? This defines a Markov transition matrix, and lambda is the second eigenvalue of that Markov transition matrix. Okay, so this is actually sort of somewhat important, but not for this talk. Okay, you can just think of lambda as being defined by this. And you'll notice, okay, A and B are supposed to be non-negative numbers, and this puts a constraint on lambda. It has to be between minus 1 over K minus 1 and 1. Right? If A equals 0, then you get this one, and if B equals 0, then you get that one. Okay. And, okay, let me also point out another thing about lambda. When A and B are far apart, then lambda is far away from zero. Right? So you should think of lambda as being some sort of measure of the strength of the signal in your graph. Ooh, the colors came out a bit funny. All right, there's supposed to be more colors in this picture. All right, so here is a phase diagram for the problems that I told you before. So there's the detectability problem and the distinguishability problem. Okay, and what happens is this region of the top here should be green. All right, it's the same color as the one at the bottom. In these two supposed to be green regions, the stochastic block model is both detectable and distinguishable. Okay? So let's see, lambda here is on the y-axis, and it runs between minus 1 and 1. Okay, d here is on the x-axis, it runs between 0 and 20. All right, and so basically what it's saying is, okay, for any particular value of lambda, let's say, once d gets big enough, then you can do it. Yeah? Okay, and this curve here that separates the detectable and distinguishable region from the undetectable and indistinguishable region, which, by the way, was supposed to be red, this is, curve is given by the equation lambda squared times d equals 1. Okay, that gives both curves. All right. So this was work a few years ago. This was joint work with Elchanan Mosel and Alan Sly, and also parts of it were done independently by Laurent Massoulier. All right. So now, okay, this was for k equals 2. Right? Yes?
What was the green shaded area?
The green shaded area, so these are both green shaded areas, and they are detectable and distinguishable. Yep. Two green areas and the red area in the middle. All right. Ah, okay, I have my colors back for some reason. Okay. This is the phase diagram. Okay, this is the conjectured phase diagram for the case k equals 20. All right, so now I have many more colors. And okay, the first thing you probably notice is that it's not symmetric anymore. This is simply because, remember, my lambda has to be between minus 1 over k minus 1 and 1. Okay, so when k equals 2, that's between minus 1 and 1. But now here, in this plot, 0 is sort of way down near the bottom. Okay, and this is minus 1 over 19. Okay, so again, you have two green regions, one here, and one sort of much smaller one down the bottom. Okay, and in these two green regions, the stochastic block model is both detectable and distinguishable. All right, again, you have a red region, okay, which is actually red this time, and in the red region, the model is undetectable and indistinguishable. Okay, but now what's interesting here is at least the conjecture is that in between the green and the red regions, you have a yellow region. And in the yellow region, maybe let me say this first. Okay, in the yellow region, it's also detectable and indistinguishable. Okay, but the difference between the yellow and the green region is that in the yellow region, it's computationally hard. Okay, so in the green region, let's say you can do everything in polynomial time, and in the yellow region, maybe it takes exponential time to do the inference problem. The boundary between the green and the yellow region is supposed to be lambda squared times d equals 1. So this is the same boundary that in the previous slide was between the green region and the red region. But now I have a yellow region in below there. Okay, and I put a dotted line here between the yellow and the red regions because, as far as I know, you don't sort of expect there to be a nice formula for it. Okay, I don't know what it's supposed to be. All right. This is part of a very nice set of conjectures by these four authors in about 2011. Okay. Yeah, so k equals 3, I think, should be the same as k equals 2, maybe. And then when k equals 4, then things start to change. Yeah, finish answering your question first. So when k equals 4, then the yellow region is supposed to appear at the bottom. When k equals 5, then the yellow region is supposed to appear at the top. Sorry? At both the bottom and the top. And from then on, you'll have a yellow region. Yeah.
Yes? So what kind of arguments do they have for this detectable but hard range? Is it like...
So it's sort of the same intuition that goes with a bunch of other random constraint satisfaction problems like KSAT and things like that. Yeah. I'll talk a little bit about this yellow region later as well. Okay, so this is the conjectured picture. So now what I want to talk to you about today is a little bit about... So we can do a little bit of this picture. All right, so in the green region, it is indeed possible to detect and to distinguish. And not only that, but it's possible to do it quickly. Okay, this is a recent result, and it's a little bit small, unfortunately, of Bordenave, Lelarge, and Massoulier, and also Abbe and Sandin early. So this sort of didn't quite do the whole thing. It was appeared last year. It was very nice, and we were going to hear about it, but unfortunately, I think we won't. And this was a paper from earlier this year. They show that in this whole conjectured green region, you can do it, and you can do it efficiently, meaning in almost linear time in the number of edges. Okay. So the work that I'm going to tell you about today, and also independently by Abe and Sandin, you can prove the existence of a sort of sliver of a yellow region just below the green region. Okay, what I mean by the sliver of a yellow region is you can prove that it's possible to detect and distinguish below the green region. Okay. What we do not yet know how to prove, and I think is a very possibly difficult problem, is to prove that it's computationally hard to do so. So the algorithms that we come up with, you'll see, are computationally hard, but we have no result that says that it must be computationally hard. Okay. And also, I want to tell you a little bit about a red region which we are able to prove that exists. Now, the problem is that all the stuff I'm going to tell you about today, so our red region and our yellow region don't touch. So we have this region in between, which is a white region. Okay, the white region should be either yellow or red. Right? Every point in the white region should be either colored yellow or red, but we don't know which color they should be. Okay.
But you don't have a proof that the yellow and the red touch.
No.
There may be something else.
No, exactly. So in particular, so for example, well, the definition of detectable ensured that detectable and undetectable are exhaustive. Every point is either detectable or undetectable, but distinguishable and indistinguishable are not exhaustive. So it's not clear that every point is one of those. And it's also not necessarily clear that the set of undetectable things and the set of indistinguishable things should coincide. Yeah. So there are various possibilities that could happen in this white region, but probably everything is either red or yellow. Yeah. Okay, so here is the result sort of in symbols instead of pictures. Okay, so you have your lambda and your k, and I define these two things, d plus and d minus, okay, with these big formulas in terms of lambda and k. All right, and the theorem is that if d is bigger than d plus, then it's detectable and distinguishable. And if d is smaller than d minus, then it's undetectable and indistinguishable. Okay, so everything that's, so if d is bigger than d plus, but smaller than the green region, then you're yellow. And indeed, if you check, all right, so maybe it's not quite obvious, you know, from this sort of large formula at the top that there is a yellow region necessarily, but you can, if you check, you'll see if when you take k to be big, then there exist lambdas such that d plus is strictly smaller than 1 over lambda, and this gives you a yellow region which is between 1 over lambda squared and d plus. Between d plus and 1 over lambda squared is your yellow region. Okay, and smaller than d minus is your red region. So, of course, it's very natural to ask, you know. So, I mean, as you saw in the picture, right, in that picture, this was actually, I was plotting these formulas. Okay, how close are d plus and d minus in general? Okay, and they are, of course, in general not equal, but at least in some limit, they become equal. Okay, so let's see. So, if I fix, first I fix lambda and I take k to infinity, then the ratio of d plus to d minus converges to, okay, this formula, mu squared over 1 plus mu log 1 plus mu minus mu, where mu is a minus b divided by the average degree. Okay, and now, okay, if you take mu to either 1 or minus 1, then this converges to 1. All right, so in that limit, the number of colors going to infinity and, mu going to either 1 or minus 1 means that either A converges to 0 or B converges to 0. Okay, so in the limit A converges to 0 or B converges to 0 and the number of colors goes to infinity, then our bounds are sharp. Everything else, they're not. All right, but they are, so for example, in the limit as K goes to infinity for every value of A and B, the ratio between our two bounds is bounded. Okay, so they're up to a constant, they're okay. These limits have a particular meaning. Okay, if A equals 0, then the coloring that I gave is a coloring in the sense of graphs, right? Coloring meaning it's a proper coloring in the sense that two nodes with the same color are never connected, right? So then this model in that limit coincides with the so-called planted coloring model. Okay, and in the planted coloring model, it was solved about 10 years ago, what's the sort of distinguishability transition for the planted coloring model. And they had sharp results as the number of colors goes to infinity. So the results that I'm going to talk about today recover those results in that limit. Okay, so we're sharp in that limit. The case where B equals 0 and A is non-zero, okay, this is sort of an easy case because, all right, in that case, all of your colors sorry, no red node will ever connect to a blue node. Right? So your colors are all sort of disconnected from each other. And now, okay, if you want to know if my colors are all disconnected from each other, well, then the obvious inference algorithm for detecting, you know, what are the colors is you take every connected component and you know that those are all one color. Right? Now, when does this do anything for you? It works exactly when there are components of linear size. Right? Because once there's a component of linear size, then you learn a sort of linear amount of information, which is what detectability was asking. Right? Okay, so when is there a component of linear size, then it's exactly sort of the emergence of the giant component, okay, which is sort of a much easier problem. Okay, and so in that limit, the problem is easy, and the methods that we do are tight in that limit. All right. So this is the main result. And I want to tell you a little bit about the various proof techniques. Let me start with the easiest part, which is the yellow region. Okay. So recall that in the yellow region, what I'm trying to do is show you that there is some algorithm, not necessarily an efficient algorithm, but some algorithm which can learn something non-trivial about the communities in this graph. Okay. So now suppose I take, so I have my graph, and it doesn't have colors with it. Okay. So I consider some partition of it into k parts of equal size. All right. Once I've taken that partition, I look at the various edges going in and out of communities in the graph, and I say that my partition is good if, on average, every node has A over K neighbors in its own partition, and B over K times K minus 1 neighbors outside the partition. All right. So, if my graph came from the stochastic block model, and you look at the hidden partition that generated the graph, then it will be good with hyperbability. Right? All right. So here are two facts. Okay. You have to sort of figure out which parameters A, B, and K these facts are true for. Okay. But I take my stochastic block model for certain choices of parameters, and then you can prove that every partition which is good is correlated with the underlying partition. Okay, that's fact one. And fact two is if you consider the Erdős-Rényi model of random graphs, then there are no good partitions. Okay. So how do you prove these two facts? They are basically sort of elementary. So maybe let me talk about this bottom one, which is maybe a little bit simpler. So I have my Erdős-Rényi graph. I take a partition, right? Now, for any fixed partition, if I take the random graph, on average, I expect D over K neighbors of my own color, and k minus 1 over k times d neighbors of the other color, right? So in order for my partition to be good, something fairly unlikely has to happen, right? These numbers of edges have to deviate from their mean by sort of a large amount, okay? And so you use formulas, okay, what's the probability that a binomial random variable deviates from its mean by such and such, right? You have a formula for that, okay, and that tells you that for a single partition, it is very unlikely to be good, and then you take a union bound over all partitions, and you see that no partitions are good. Right. So, of course, there's, in doing this concentration in the union bound, you have to figure out what are exactly the parameters A, B, and K, such that the concentration beats the union bound. Okay, and this gives you the formula, in fact, that you had on the previous slide. Okay, the first bullet point is basically the same. Okay, if I have my stochastic block model and I take a partition which is not correlated with the true partition, then the expected degrees are the same as they would be for the Erdős-Rényi graph. Okay, so you can basically do the same argument. It's just a little bit more complicated because you have sort of binomials with different parameters and so on, but it's really not difficult. Okay. So these are the two facts that you prove using concentration in the union bound. Okay, and now to connect it to my two problems of detecting and distinguishing. Okay, if I want to detect... If I want to distinguish my graph, I want to say, did it come from an Erdős-Rényi graph or from the stochastic block model? Well, you look at the second bullet point here. Okay, the stochastic block model has no good partitions, right? Sorry, the Urdesreni graph has no good partitions. The stochastic block model certainly has a good partition because the hidden partition is good. And so I just look over all partitions in my graph and I say, is there a good one or not? And this is going to tell me whether or not I came from the stochastic block model or the Urdesreni model. Okay, and now for my algorithm for detecting what the partition was, I use the first bullet point. Okay, the first bullet point tells me that all good partitions are correlated with the truth. So I just look over all possible partitions, I find one that's good, and I know that this one is a non-trivial detection algorithm. Okay, now obviously the two algorithms that I gave here for distinguishing and detecting are not computationally efficient because you have to go over basically exponentially many possible partitions. All right. So as I mentioned, Abe and Sandin proved this independently. Actually, they proved something sort of a little bit better, slightly better parameters than we did. You can improve this argument with some sort of a little bit more work. So the point is that in looking at these partitions and so on, it's a little bit wasteful to consider partitions of the whole vertices, of all the vertices, because a constant fraction of the vertices, in fact, do not belong to the interesting part, which is the giant component. Okay, so you can prune all the things that are not in the giant component. And you can even do a little bit better because the giant component in a graph like this, okay, it has sort of, this graph-like part, and then it has a bunch of trees sort of hanging off the edges. If you prune the trees, you also get rid of another constant fraction of the vertices, okay, and they're sort of not so interesting for inference because you don't really learn much from trees. So if you do these sort of two pruning steps, then you reduce the number of vertices by a constant fraction and you're sort of able to improve the parameters a little bit in this argument. Okay, they improve mostly when the degree is small, because when the degree is small, then you throw away quite a bit of stuff by these pruning steps. Okay, so that's the yellow region. Okay, so then let me tell you also a bit about the red region. Okay, and there's various things, so, I claimed various properties of the red region, right? I claimed that it's undetectable and indistinguishable. Okay, and indistinguishable includes within it two statements, right? One is, indistinguishable says that, the Urdesreni probability of an event converges to zero if and only if the stochastic block model probability of an event converges to zero, so there's sort of two directions to show. All right, so let me start, with one direction. If I want to show, the probability under Qn of An goes to zero implies the probability of Pn under An goes to zero, it's sufficient to show that the density of P with respect to Q, the second moment of that under Q is bounded as n goes to infinity. Right? So this is just sort of Cauchy-Schwarz, right? Because Pn of An, I can write that as the expectation under Qn of the indicator of An times dPn dQn. Okay, and then Cauchy-Schwarz, expectation under Qn of 1 of An squared, but I can forget the square. Okay, and then the expectation under Qn of the density squared. Okay, now, if I know that this thing is going to zero and this thing is bounded, then it implies that this thing is going to zero also. Okay, so now, all right, I want to do the second moment thing, okay, and I'm going to do this with Pn being my stochastic block model and Qn being the Urdesreni model. All right, and now the thing is that for these particular models, you can really write out explicitly what the density is, right? So the Urdesreni density, right, is every edge appeared with probability d over n, and every non-edge did not appear with probability 1 minus d over n. Okay, and in the numerator, every edge appeared with probability either a or b over n, depending on what the labeling, what the coloring was, and every non-edge did not appear with probability 1 minus that, okay, again, depending on what the labeling was, and you have to also take the average over all possible labelings. Right? When I write this density, I mean just the graphs, right, so the labelings, the colorings here are sort of marginalized out. Okay, so now I can square this thing. All right, and you get some sort of very explicit thing, right? You have a sum over all pairs of labelings of a bunch of products here, of things that depend on, you know, what are the... So this A or B depends on what sigma was, and this A or B depends on what tau was. Okay, and you get this sort of very explicit formula. And under Q, here, you can easily take the expectation of this, okay, because under Q, the event of appearance of an edge is independent over all edges, and so you, all these products factorize. Okay, you do everything. You sort of tailor expand these things because you don't like that in the denominator and so on. Okay, and you get a very explicit formula for what this second moment is. It's some explicit constant, okay, up to an error term, the expectation of the exponential of a quadratic form, okay, where this x here, so B is an explicit matrix, and the x is a multinomial vector of length k squared. So basically, if you think about it, okay, you have all of these terms which are A or B, right, and whether they're A or B depends on whether the endpoints have the same color or different colors. Now, if I were to tell you, for every I and J, two colors, how many nodes are there with label I under, with color I under sigma and color J under tau? If I gave you all of those numbers, then you would be able to figure out exactly how many times this was an A and how many times it was a B. Okay. And also, you know, every pair, right? So telling you those numbers sort of determines everything in this formula. Okay, and those numbers, well, there are k squared of those numbers, because for every I and every j, there's a number. And with respect to this sort of averaging over here, those numbers are multinomial counts. Okay, so this is that's what you get. Okay, now, I don't know how to compute the expectation of the exponential of a multinomial quadratic form, okay, but if I were allowed to use the central limit theorem, then I could replace the multinomial quadratic form with a Gaussian quadratic form. And for Gaussian quadratic forms, I know how to compute it, okay, and you get a very explicit formula for what this limiting second moment is. There's an explicit function, okay, which is maybe not so important here, except for this feature, this function psi is finite whenever x is strictly smaller than 1. Okay, and okay, in order to get this limit, you have to plug in what's the covariance of these explicit Gaussian things and what's the explicit matrix B, some computation, okay, and you get psi of lambda squared d to the power k minus 1. Okay, and the limit is finite whenever lambda squared d is smaller than 1. Okay, so this is, in fact, everywhere below the green region, this limit here is finite. Okay, so that... So something is wrong, right, because, of course, the red region was not supposed to extend to the whole green region, and the problem was in exchanging the multinomials with Gaussians, right? So I have multinomials that converge in distribution to Gaussian, but this does not imply that the expectation of something converges to the expectation of something, right? If I want that to happen, I need the thing that I have the expectation with, I need this to be uniformly integrable, okay, as n goes to infinity. And so now the question becomes, all right, when is this exponential quadratic form of multinomials uniformly integrable? All right. And now the thing is, right, okay, I have an exponential, I have a quadratic form, and I can also look at what's the probability density of a multinomial. The probability of a probability density of a multinomial is like e to the n times an entropy. Right? And now the question for this to be uniformly integrable is the question of when does the entropy kill the quadratic form? Right? Now, I know they sort of cancel out at one particular point, which is the point where the Gaussian is accurate. Okay, and now the question is there some other point where the multinomial dominates the... where the quadratic form dominates the entropy? Okay, and the thing is uniformly integrable if and only if there are no other maximums of this thing. Okay, so this maybe doesn't seem like we've made much progress. Okay, I started with this second moment, and I've converted it into some sort of strange optimization problem, wanting to know if it has a unique maximum at a particular point. All right. But this optimization problem has already been studied. It was studied by Akleoptis and Noor in about 2005, I think, who gave a sufficient condition for this thing to be maximized at the point you care about. Okay. Now, why were they looking at optimization problems of this form? They were studying planted colorings. And remember, planted colorings were exactly the case of stochastic block models where A equals 0. Okay. And what they did was they gave sufficient conditions for this sort of optimizations to have the right minimum or maximum in that setting. And their results were sharp in the limit as the number of colors went to infinity. Okay, and so I mentioned earlier that our results are sharp in that limit also. It's coming from the fact that we're sort of really applying the same method at a crucial point. Okay, so this is the proof of half of the indistinguishability argument, right? It's a second moment. You convert it into an optimization problem. At some point, you have to know where the maximum of this optimization problem is, and you plug in the estimates of Akleoptis and Noor to get a sufficient condition. Okay. For the other direction, okay, so in order to show that sort of Pn is somehow bounded by Qn, you have to show that the density of P with respect to Q does not blow up. Okay. If I want to do the other direction, to show that somehow Qn is dominated by Qn is dominated by Pn in some sense, then I have to show that this density is bounded away from zero. Okay. And so for this, we use a method from the 90s due to Robinson and Wormald called the small subgraph conditioning method. And basically, the sort of slightly amazing thing is that if I want to figure out what this density is, right? Okay, so I gave you a formula for this density. If I give you a graph, you could, in principle, compute exactly what the density is by summing over all possible labelings of, you know, products of whatever. Okay, but it's actually better than that. It turns out if I give you a graph and you want to know what's the likelihood ratio between the stochastic block model and the Oded-Shireny model, you can do it by counting the number of short cycles in the graph that you have. Okay, so I give you a graph, you count all cycles of length up to 100, okay, and then you plug in these numbers that you got into some formula, and it will tell you approximately what the likelihood ratio is. Okay, and as a result of this, you can actually figure out, okay, this is a random variable under the measure Qn, okay, it has a limiting distribution. And the limiting distribution is something that you can write down sort of very explicitly. I mean, it's not a super simple formula. It's a bunch of sort of exponentials, you know, things to the power of independent Poisson random variables. And then you multiply those all together. Okay. But the point is, it's something very explicit. And when you write it down very explicitly, you see that it's never zero. Okay. So this density is bounded, is really bounded away from zero. And so you can sort of do the other direction of the indistinguishability. So this is actually sort of very nice because this method has proved to be sort of quite a powerful method. And as a result, people have sort of streamlined it to the point where you don't actually have to do that much work in order to apply it. Okay, the main thing that you have to do, at least for this application, is to figure out what's the limiting second moment. Okay, that's sort of the hardest part in applying all of this machinery, and we've already done it. Okay. All right, so that's... Yes.
So one point, usually if you work like with GMP models and so on, one does not need to do this small subgraph conditioning method. So why doesn't this frequent stuff apply in your setting?
Sorry, which?
Usually one does not need to do the small subgraph conditioning mm-hmm. for like GMP type models because of the sharp threshold results. So why does that not work in your setting?
So I'm not quite sure how to...
So let's maybe ask.
Okay. So I mean, okay. So there is a sharp threshold here, but I'm not quite sure how the okay. Okay. So now let me say a little bit about the problem of undetectability. So here I want to show that for a certain regime of parameters, it is not possible to non-trivially figure out what the colors were, right? So now one way to do that is. The following sort of easier thing, all right, if it were possible to non-trivially figure out the colors in the graph, then it would also be possible to do the following. I pick two vertices uniformly at random, and I ask you, do they or do they not have the same color? Right? If you can get a non-trivial global coloring of the whole thing, then you can certainly answer this problem. Okay. So now I want to show that this problem is impossible. All right. Now, if I give you two vertices, and I ask you, do they have the same color or not, there is a very obvious algorithm which is the best possible algorithm that you could do in order to figure out the answer, which is you say, what's the conditional probability of getting my graph given that they have the same color? What's the conditional probability of getting the graph given that they did not have the same color? And whichever one is bigger is going to tell you what your answer should be. Okay. So in order to show that this problem is impossible, it suffices to show that the conditional distribution of the graph that you see is not really affected by conditioning on the labels of these two vertices. Okay? So I fix two vertices, and I consider two different probability measures, which are the conditional distribution of my stochastic block model, given two different labelings on these two guys. Okay, and what I need to show is that these two distributions are close, in the sense that the total variation distance between them goes to zero as n goes to infinity. Okay, so the nice thing about total variation distance is that I can always write the total variation distance as the L1 distance between two densities with respect to whichever reference measure I like. Okay, and I like the Oder-Sereny reference measure. Okay? So now I do a Jensen inequality. Okay, it suffices to show that the these densities converge to each other in L2, okay, instead of L1. And then I can sort of expand this guy out, and I get sort of three terms, right? I get this guy squared, I get this guy squared, and I get a cross term. Now, if all of the terms that I get are basically the same, then this second moment goes to zero. Right? So basically what I want to do is I want to show that all of these terms, which basically look like second moments except with a little bit of extra conditioning, have the same limit. Okay, and now this is sort of very similar to what I did before in the second moment computation, just a very slight difference that now I'm conditioning on a little bit of information, but when you go through the same computation that you had to do before, you sort of easily see that that little bit of extra information is basically doesn't change anything. Okay, so this shows undetectability. All right, so just to sort of summarize what the proof was, in order to show this red region, this region of indistinguishability and undetectability, basically everything follows from doing second moments of these densities. Okay. In order to show that the second moment is bounded, then we use machinery of Akleoptis and Noor, which was developed in order to solve the special case of planted colorings. Okay. And this allows us to get explicit inequalities telling us when the second moment converges to something finite. Okay. So just to wrap up, here's the picture. Okay, and remember that the conjecture was that this white region is filled by either red and yellow. Okay, so there are two main open problems which remain. The first one is to fill in everything that's white, okay, by either something red or something yellow. And the second problem is, so I think I said it before, but let me say it again. The results that we have about the yellow region say that it's possible to do something in this region, but we have no results saying that it's computationally hard to do something. So this seems to be actually sort of quite a hard problem, okay? I mean, it's sort of fairly important for this picture because so far we haven't actually proved that there is anything separating the green region from the yellow region, right? What we know is that in the green region there exist efficient algorithms, and we do not know this for the yellow region. Okay, but we do not yet know any properties that separate these two regions. So that's all. Thank you. Yeah.
So you mean these bounds are like achievability results, not the converse bounds? So you have
yes.
The technique.
Yes.
And for none of these regions, you know any converse? I mean, do you have any idea about the tightness of any of these bounds, even in the limit? In some sense.
So we do have some results about the tightness in some limits. So as the number of colors goes to infinity, this strip of unknown stuff vanishes. The fact that we're able to prove the existence of a red region is some sort of lower bound on the green region, right? It means that the green region does not extend down to here.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the bound that we give on the red region, we certainly don't believe it should be tight. Of the bounds that I told you, the only one that we believe should be tight is the boundary of the green region. Yeah. Yeah.
As k goes to infinity, doesn't the green curve just go all the way down?
Yeah, it's basically sort of one of a log k or something like that.
Huh?
So Sorry, this is the green. Say it again.
As k goes to infinity, doesn't the green curve fill up everything? Didn't you just slowly descend? I mean, because the lower bound goes up to zero, right?
So the green region should always be at lambda squared d equals 1.
Lambda squared d.
Yeah. So as k goes to infinity, that does not change. But what is supposed to happen is that as k goes to infinity, then the red region shrinks to nothing. Yeah, so the ratio between the green and the red should be like 1 over log k, I think, as k goes to infinity. And yellow should become very prominent. Yeah.
So the stochastic block model is like a special case of this inhomogeneous random graph.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any way to phrase these questions in that more general setting and what's known there?
So off the top of my head, I'm not completely sure. But yeah, I'm pretty sure you should be able to do to say something about it. So I mean, the inhomogeneous random graph case sort of corresponds to where you have a continuous collection of colors. So you need to come up with a definition. So distinguishability, you can, you know, completely translates to this framework. I'm not sure about detectability, what exactly that would mean.
If your blocks have different probabilities depend on the colors. That's a more general model.
So we can do those more general models to a certain extent, in the sense that the second moment still sort of tells you everything you need to know. But the stuff from Acleoptis and Noor about how to find explicit bounds on parameters for which these second moments work, I don't know how to do that in general. So you can somehow, you know, give characterizations of what these curves are, but they're very non-explicit.
Okay.